It is 4:46 p.m., and I'm going to officially call this meeting to order. Could we begin roll call?
Amir Akhtar, here. David Bateman.
Here.
Victoria Bell.
Present.
Marcy Benda.
Present.
Marcy's here.
Yes,
we see you,
Yes,
Marcy.
I'm here. Sorry. Yes.
No worries.
Nicholas Brennan. Susan Breyer. Jonathan Butcher.
Here.
Anna Fernandez Cardenas. Ishan Chowdhury.
He was on. He's on.
You have to put here in the chat.
Oh, here.
Jason Choberko. Zora Durham. Dave DeRosa.
Here.
Ellen Gaynor.
Here.
Andy Garcia Ortiz. Irene Gattini.
Present.
Andrea Healy Mott.
Present.
Han Nguyen. Stephanie Rizzo. Christian Torala. Wendy Treat.
Present.
You have 11.
Okay, awesome. Thank you and welcome, everybody. We're going to go ahead and start with an acknowledgement. Cornell University, where this meeting is located, is on the traditional homelands of the Gayokono, the Cayuga Nation. The Gayokono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayokono disposition and honor the ongoing connection of Gayokono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. At this time, I'm going to open the floor to any late additions to the agenda. Seeing that there is none, we're now going to close this portion of the meeting and move on to the approval of our February 24th meeting minutes. Those are on the box for those online and in person. And we have a packet for those that are in person here. And I'll entertain any motion to amend or approve.
Motion to approve.
Motion to approve. Awesome. Do we get a second?
Second.
Awesome. And with that, the meeting minutes are approved. We can now move on to our business of the day, which I'm very excited about. Today we have Julie Edwards from Health Promotions Initiatives on Campus going to be talking about that. Can we go ahead and give her a round of applause? Sure.
Do you want to control your thing, or do you want me to do it? Okay. Thank you. There we go. I know it was a group. It's please the.
Oh, okay. Hello, everyone. I'm Julie Edwards. I'm the Assistant Vice President for Student Health and Wellbeing. So, part of my role, I oversee Cornell Health, and then I also oversee our Health Promoting Campus Initiative, as well as wellbeing efforts across campus. And my colleague, Greta Kenny, is not able to join today. She oversees student support and advocacy. And so, what I'm going to do is share a bit about our wellbeing support that we provide for students specifically. So I think it's always helpful to start with just philosophy and guiding principles. And what we try to do is really think about well-being holistically. And so how might I do that? We want to think about systems and settings approaches because we recognize that in order to support well-being, we really need to think about not just individual level, but interpersonal as well as the systems and settings within the university. And so we strive to build policies that support health and well-being across the institution. We really look at ways that we might be able to create supportive environments at all levels of the social ecological model, strengthening community action, so hoping that everyone can see the role that they play in this work, and how might we create opportunities for folks to develop personal skills to take care of themselves and also support one another. Another key piece, obviously, I oversee Cornell Health, and so we provide a lot of health and mental health services, but we want to reorient health services. So how do we think not just about treating illness, but how can we be very proactive in thinking about the root causes that might impact folks? And so that's why we work with thinking about social determinants of health and ways that we can create better access, as an example. We also want to look at ways that we might be able to help folks increase health-seeking behaviors. I'll share some of the ways in which we're doing that, but just to touch on it, we're offering community-based services now, and that's an example of that piece. And then lastly, just thinking about promoting well-being across the university. This is our mental health framework at Cornell, and it's been in existence for over a decade. I'm not sure if anyone has seen this before, but I just want to share a little bit because there's multiple steps. And what I like about this framework is that it's a public health approach where we want everyone to be able to see the role that they might play. So the lower purple, it shows providing mental and medical health services. So obviously that's provided within Cornell Health, but we work very closely with the Ithaca community as well, because students might be receiving services there. How can we continue to provide services not only on campus, but also smooth and seamless transitions to community resources, as an example? And we want to make sure that supports are available for students in all aspects of their college experience. Undergraduate students might need different services than graduate and professional students. And so we recognize that. And also, how can we become familiar with the resources that exist across campus for spouses, for dependents, and those types of things as well. And we also recognize that all aspects here are necessary for whole systems change. So we want to think about not only fostering a healthy educational environment that's at the very top of the pie, but going all across, thinking about social connectedness, that help-seeking behavior, being able to identify individuals in need, providing the services needed. I'll talk about the coordinated crisis management, and then also restricting access to means of suicide. So we really try to take this holistic approach, both proactively and when someone might be in crisis. So you may have heard of this before, but when David Skorton was president here at Cornell, he really coined the term a caring community. And so what we strive to do is, how can we work collaboratively together? So it's not just on one department or one person, but how can we really think about collaboration and coordinated care to continue to provide a caring environment here so that we're supporting folks in the ways they need it most? So this graphic shows just the ways in which we think about this. So sorry, I know with captions, you're not able to see the bottom there. But when we think about holistic care upstream, that's where we may change various laws or policies or regulations or even practices or norms that are across campus. So how do we think proactively about some of those things? And I'll give some examples in a few slides. Midstream is where we're actually delivering some services. So we might be providing workshops or education. Also screenings and referrals, because that helps get folks connected maybe at an earlier stage. And then lastly, downstream is where there's crisis management and really providing urgent care services to anyone who may come in. But I'm going to focus primarily on students in my presentation. So some of the benefits, the reason why we want to look at upstream approaches is, first, we can really think about the policies that exist and how can we build healthy policies. How do we create those supportive environments that tie back to those guiding principles? Strengthening community action, again, so that we all see the role that we play. And if someone is in a department or a college or school and they see something that might be of concern, making sure that they feel comfortable in raising that so that we can try and address it as a campus community. Developing personal skills, and again, reorienting those health services so that we're not just treating illness, but we're really thinking proactively about health and well-being. So when we talk upstream and kind of the policies and regulations, I wanted to give just a few examples of what we've done here at Cornell over the past couple of years. policies that have changed. We have had credit caps that have been in place for about 2 years now in different colleges and schools. There were two changes to the transcripts for students. The median grade was removed, as well as the asterisk. So for students who had an incomplete, and then they went through the course or completed that course, their grade on their transcript would have had an asterisk after it because they had an incomplete prior. That has now since been removed because what we were hearing is that it was causing distress when students were submitting transcripts or things like that for career options. So those were some policy changes. At the systems level, so campus-wide, we adopted the Okanagan Charter. So where we're looking and making a commitment to be health promoting in what we do. And this screenshot of the Mental Health at Cornell website also serves as a system. This is supposed to serve as a one-stop shop because we heard regularly from students that they don't know where to go to find the resources that exist. And so there's a Get Support tab on that page, and we've done our best to continue to iterate on that based on student feedback so that it's a one-stop shop directing you to the different departments and resources that exist. From a culture standpoint, we have now for, this is going on year four, we actually have a standalone student well-being survey that goes out in May. It helps us track on trends and identify some opportunities for future and our health promoting campus efforts. And structurally, there are different initiatives. So well-being and scholarly environments is one where our teams are working closely with faculty to embed well-being into the classroom and labs across campus. So those are just some examples of the ways in which we try to think about upstream approaches. Midstream, so again, thinking about education and the ways in which we're providing services, we do have bystander intervention training. So there's notice and respond where you can talk through how to identify signs of distress and get folks connected to resources, as well as intervene that takes students through different scenarios and how to respond in those situations. In our primary care services, we actually are now conducting mental health screenings because sometimes students might not be comfortable in going to counseling. And so by providing some of these screenings in primary care, we might be able to get folks connected or at least talk about the resources that exist. We also have now launched community-based services, and this Cornell Chronicle article is highlighted here. We received a $20 million gift to actually expand our embedded therapists as well as well-being coaching. And so those folks are actually the new embedded therapists. There's going to be 7 total. We have 3 additional right now. They are located in academic buildings. So MVR, Ives Hall, and Rhodes Hall are where the existing ones are. And we will be hiring 4 more for fall. But the whole point is that knowing that students are not always able to come to the Cornell Health Building, how can we bring services out into the community to provide better access? There's a student of concern form so that if anyone identifies a concern, they can fill out that form and student support and advocacy will connect with the student and just provide the variety of resources that exist. We also have case management services. I'll talk on the next slide. And there's a dean of the day drop-in. So we have a person available at Willard Street Hall. So if a student is experiencing some form of distress or just has questions, they can drop in and talk to someone right away. And a little bit more about case management and why it's effective. We recognize that not every challenge that a student experiences needs a clinical intervention. And so because of that, that's where case management can come in, and that's why student support and advocacy services was created. In real time, students can come in, and if it's during the normal hours that they're open, they can walk in and be seen by someone. And really, they help them problem solve, identify maybe some goals that they might need to navigate, and also get connected to some of the campus resources. And then lastly, from downstream, so thinking about crisis services, treatment, and intervention, there is an administrator on call that's available 24/7. So if something happens, we recognize not all crises happen during business hours, and so people are available 24/7. So that if students need to get connected, they can. We also have our Department of Public Safety. There's a community response team. Those folks can go to a location that's on campus And then we have, obviously, CUPD, who's also available to provide support. And then within Cornell Health, on our medical side, we have eating concerns, medication management, and then also counseling and psychological services. And we have urgent care counselors as well as after hours line so that students can get connected, call, and at least talk to someone on the phone. And then we may be paged and have some of our on-call folks actually connect if needed. And from a crisis response standpoint, really what we're trying to do across Cornell's campus is to create an interconnected system so that it's not, again, just one department, but how are we working collaboratively together? So all of these areas, we're not only working on campus, but we work with the Ithaca Police Department. There's an Ithaca care team, so any individuals of concern in the community. And then we also work very closely with PAVES so that we can get students connected to the care that they might need there. And to talk a little bit about our care team, and this is something that Greta actually chairs with the team within Student Support and Advocacy Services. This is another way where we're bringing folks together across campus where we're discussing what students may need, especially students who are experiencing a crisis situation. How might we help them get connected? Maybe they need to miss classes. Maybe they need support for housing, for instance. So this team comes together to talk from the academic side as well as the student services side. And then also we can help coordinate health leaves of absence as needed. And that's based on the student's desire. And just one thing I want to note is that the student's first connection can be any of these avenues. And so that's why we need to make sure that we're as consistent as possible, as well as collaborative and comprehensive as possible. And so we want to make sure that there's no wrong door, that a student connects with any of our areas. And if they do, they're getting a consistent message, and then we're referring to the appropriate resources as needed. And one thing I just wanted to note, this is a lot of text on the slide, happy to share slides afterwards, but I mentioned that student well-being survey. What we're doing is we actually, now this is year four, this May will be the fourth time so far, we're evaluating not only psychological distress, but we're also evaluating flourishing. And you can find, we've published a few articles, but you can find our reports on our Health Promoting Campus website. And the reason is because historically, we've only looked at distress. And the reality is, we can be experiencing distress and still be well. And so that's what we're actually finding, is that there might be someone who's experiencing low distress, but is feeling as if they're languishing. And then on the flip side, there might be someone who's experiencing significant distress, but is continuing to go through and persist in not only academics, but social life. And so that's the reality. So it gives us a better picture of looking at these complementary pathways. And so that's where we're evaluating it in general. And lastly, I just wanted to share, these are some of the resources. So we have Cornell Health, our website number, Student Support and Advocacy Services. As I mentioned, it is drop-in during business hours. We also, at Cornell Health, folks can drop in. We have urgent care counselors available. The Public Safety Communication Center is where students can get connected, whether it's CPD or the Community Response Team. And then with Housing and Res Life, an RA or a GRF on call is available. And then I already shared a screenshot of this, but this is our Mental Health at Cornell website. So in the upper left is that Get Support page. There's a tab for helping others, a tab for self-care, and ways if folks want to get involved in anything that I've mentioned today. So that is the end of my presentation, and I'll turn it over to questions if anyone has them, or if I can provide any clarification.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Can we go ahead? Oh, cool.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm opening the floor to any questions.
Thank you. Could you just talk a little bit more about the $20 million grant that was received and who it was from, and the parameters? I know a little bit about it, but I think it's important to talk about that and how sustainable
Absolutely. Thank you for the question. Yes. So Melissa and John Cirielli are the two individuals who actually gifted us $20 million. It's a restricted gift. So it is specifically for embedded therapy and well-being coaching. And it is a current use gift. So meaning that it's not endowed. So that $20 million kicks out every year, about $1.3 million every year over the course of 15 years. So the gift is to last 15 years. With the gift, we were able to hire an assistant director who oversees all of our embedded services. We are hiring 7 embedded therapists. So they will be. So we hired 3 last fall and we'll be hiring 4 this fall. And they'll be located in academic buildings. That was one of the pieces that they recognize. We have 1 embedded therapist who's already in CVM. They have been, and 1 in athletics. And the Cirielli family found that it, or they felt in conversation with us, that it'd be incredibly helpful to have therapists embedded in academic buildings where students are taking classes or have access. And so that's why they felt strongly, because not only do they provide clinical services, they also engage with the college and school to understand the culture, so they can understand the ebb and flow of the academic year, can understand some of the pain points, for instance, maybe provide targeted workshops or just interventions in general that might be helpful. And so that is that piece. For well-being coaching, we currently have 23 coaches, and they are full-time staff, actually, but they give us 2 hours a week to serve as a coach. And so they're all across campus. And then through the gift, we will be able to provide stipends, continued stipends, for up to 8 to 10 coaches per year for 15 years. So that's a huge amount to provide. And the coaching program is amazing, because what we see it as a sweet spot between clinical care and advising. So that maybe a student doesn't want to speak about something with their advisor because that person is in their college or school, and maybe they don't need clinical care. And so coaching is a nice opportunity where they can help a student. Maybe it's motivational interviewing. Student can come in, identify what they want to discuss. They kind of talk through some goals that the student might want to create. And we have such positive feedback from students. We've seen across all of the areas that we're measuring right now that there are positive impacts, statistically significant. So it's really exciting to see. And part of the gift is a rigorous evaluation of everything. So we are in the process of looking at embedded in coaching, students who come into Cornell Health for services, and then students who don't need any mental health services, and trying to see, are there changes at all, or are they different changes based on the mode of service?
Just a couple of follow-up questions. Within that, are there plans to try to figure out how to sustain the money?
Oh, yes. Yes. So we that had to be built in. So yeah. Those were a lot of conversations. So every year we have turnover, obviously, with staff going on to other areas within Cornell or outside of Cornell. And so we will continue to explore the outcomes of the embedded therapy specifically. And then we might scale back on the central therapist, like within Cornell. We currently have about 35 in our building, in addition to the ones that we'll be adding. So if folks leave, we'll continue to evaluate, do we need them centrally? Might we put them elsewhere across campus? Or do we just not fill that role? And so those are some of the things that we're continuing to look at as we monitor the data.
And are they alums, the folks that?
No, actually they are not.
Really?
Yes.
What?
But John was on our board.
Oh.
So yeah, John was done. He just transitioned off of the board of trustees. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Does anyone else have questions? Yes.
So I have two quick questions.
Yeah.
One is, I've heard a lot of difficult stories from students and faculty about their experiences on health leaves of absences.
Yes.
And particularly instances where students or faculty are being tasked with work during their HLOA, or alternatively being kept out of benchmark progress steps, such as a third year review or something like this.
Sure.
Because of their HLOA, so they, instead of being required to sort of produce a dossier, being asked to produce a dossier, the department just goes ahead with the review as though without them.
Wow. Okay.
So the first question would just be, would you guys be the place to go to when those situations arise so that the offending party can be?
Well, if there's an issue on the student side, yeah. So Student Disability Services is within Cornell Health.
Great.
And Andrea Kylie is our point of contact for students returning from a health leave of absence. So she's normally the first, I guess, line of defense. So if a student is experiencing challenges, they can connect with her. On the staff and faculty side, we do have a medical leaves office. And so that's through, I don't know if it's under human resources or affiliated, but the medical leaves office would be the area for staff and faculty.
Great, and thank you very much. That's very helpful. And the second concern, sort of the extreme cases you were suggesting here, I'm curious as to what procedures exist regarding Cornell's involuntarily committing students.
Sure.
So who's authorized to do this? What processes do you need to go through in order to do this? And do we track how many students are involuntarily committed per year?
Sure. As far as Cornell in general, I am unaware of any student that has been involuntarily committed because we do not have that capacity, because we do not have an inpatient psychiatric facility or behavioral health unit. So what happens if we, so I'll give an example. If we have a student who comes in who's experiencing some form of a mental health crisis, and if we deem them to be a potential concern to themselves or others, if they've talked about taking their life, for instance, we may have them transported to the hospital. And so that does happen. We do have the numbers. I don't have them readily available, but sometimes students will be transported to the emergency room at Cayuga Medical Center, and they will do their own assessment. And so that assessment then will determine whether or not a student needs to be hospitalized. Sometimes after a transport, a student is hospitalized based on their assessment. And sometimes we've had students who have actually been discharged afterwards. So it really just depends on the situation.
So what is the trigger for Cornell deciding to send a student to?
Well, it would be more if they're at risk of harm to themselves or others, really. That's when they're transported, at least from Cornell Health. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
And I see Ellen.
Thank you. I know over, the past several years, there has been a lot of student concern about access to CAPS, long waiting times, inability to see a counselor for any extended period of time, and maybe the students get referred off campus to other care providers. Has the gift that you've mentioned alleviated some of that, or could you give us an update on the current situation in CAPS in terms of ease of access, extent of treatment, et cetera?
Oh, sure. Thank you, Ellen. Yes, so I've been here just over 4 years. And we have been fortunate in that time that we have not had significant wait times in any way. We actually provide both in-person and telehealth services within CAPS, it depends on what a student, if a student is coming in and say they have had an ongoing appointment with the therapist, as an example, and they want to be seen weekly, we just don't have the capacity to see students on a weekly basis. Mm-hmm. So we may actually refer them out into the community if that's the level of care that they're requesting. Now, if a student comes in and they want to be seen, typically it really is up to the clinical judgment of the providers, but we are a short-term model. So normally students would come in and be seen about every other week for care. And then it's kind of checking in at the end of the semester to see if in fact they need to be seen on an ongoing basis. Right now, I believe it's about 7 days wait time, and that's actually for the third next available. That's like a measure we use in healthcare. And it just means we know sometimes the first available doesn't work with a student's schedule. So right now it's 7 days for the third next available. So a fairly good wait time as far as access in general. And with the added therapists, it's just going to be able to increase that access even more.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions? Okay, seeing that there's none, let's go ahead and thank you for her time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next, we can move on to our next item, University Hearing and Review Panel. So I sent out an email to you all. So I just want to briefly remind everyone that this is a solicitation. Basically, we're trying to solicit interests for this panel. It's a University Hearing Review Panel. And so this panel participates in a formal hearing process under the Student Code of Conduct. Let's just sit with that. We're currently looking to fill several vacancies, including student, faculty, and staff positions for terms running from June 1st, 2026 through May 31st, 2028. So I really want to highlight the fact that this application, or I guess interest form, is due April 1st. So I want to just take a moment to just let people know that's coming up soon. And so if you know anyone in your networks that might be interested, please take a look at that email, share it with your communities. We're really looking for thoughtful and committed individuals who are looking to, you know, participate. And so I'd really appreciate your help in that. I'd like to ask if chairs to various committees could let their membership know, because I know not everyone in our committees are UA members. And then similarly, for those that are presiding over other assemblies, UA, myself, EA, GPSA, Student Assembly, Faculty Senate, also share with your bodies this form so you can help in that endeavor. And so we have quite a decent amount of positions open. Yes?
Yeah, point of information, the availability or in order to actually sign up, you can't be a member of GPSA or Student Assembly?
Yes, so you can't be a member of GPSA or Student Assembly.
Nice.
And so when GPSA and Student Assembly looks for members, it would have to be members that are participating in your various committees that aren't official members of your body.
Hmm. So that only classifies voting members. So if there's a non-voting member who's participating in a committee,
Okay. Thank you for that point of clarification. Any other questions regarding that? Yes.
Just a quick comment to everybody. This is I serve in these panels past. It's very enlightening experience. It's also sort of like the central mechanism through which the Student Code of Conduct is enforced. And it is, I think, very, very important that people be on there. So the more we can do to encourage people to be on there, one of the reasons I just want quickly to say is one of the reasons why delays happen, not the only reason, but one of them is that actually staffing these panels can be quite difficult because there's the pool of people doing it is not large. And so that leads to clear injustices for students.
Thank you for that. Any other questions regarding item B? Yes, Wendy.
I just wanted to clarify, Irene, there is only one staff position on the University Hearing and Review Panel that starts on June 1st.
Hearing. Let me just check back on my email that I sent out.
I mean, while I'm looking at the email, I just want to clarify, because it does say for the upcoming cycle, the University Hearing and Review Panel anticipates the following vacancies: 14 student positions, 1 staff position, and 7 faculty position. So does that mean there's other staff that, like, I'm pretty sure that there's like overlap, and Office of the Assemblies can correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I just want to make sure that it's only one staff member. I did forward the email to the rest of the Employee Assembly voting members as well. Because
yeah,
there's not that stipulation of if you're on the EA, you cannot be on this. It's just the Student Assembly, GPSA, and Office of the Assemblies, you can't be on this panel.
Yes, I can confirm that stipulation is correct. I saw Jessica raise her hand if you want to add anything else.
Yeah, I was just going to add, from my few years, almost 4 now, in this office, my understanding is that staff volunteer for this role much more readily than students and faculty. So I think there's probably the staff positions are mostly full. So just having one open staff position sounds reasonable to me.
Yeah, but
and you can share this with your constituents too. It doesn't have to be just assembly members.
Right.
Your newsletters and such.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. But Wendy's brought up a very powerful point that there are 14 vacancies for student positions, 1 for staff, and 7 for faculty. So I really just urge you guys to reach out to your networks, because for these student positions, especially for GPSA and Student Assembly, it'll be rather difficult, I can imagine, given that you can't have people that are in both. And so, any other questions about that? Awesome. Okay. In that case, we can move on to the Assembly's leadership breakfast updates. So we recently had a breakfast hosted by, I'm assuming, Office of Assembly and Kyle Kimball. We were, some of the topics that were spoken about in that meeting was security on campus, as well as the student code of conduct of people that were there. I know Andrew was there, so we can both kind of speak to some of the topics that were discussed, but of which, and Jason was also there, so you can also feel free to talk about some of the topics that were discussed, but I think a really important
point. Ishan as well.
Who is that?
Ishan is online.
And Ishan is online. So I just wanted to open the floor to kind of talk about that, answer any questions people may have had of one of the things, like I said, student code of conduct was the recent release of kind of the edits that were provided. I think a major point of conversation was temporary suspensions now being called emergency suspensions, and that there is now a higher threshold to admit those, and a lot of documentation that is required for an emergency suspension. That being said, although I think one of the major concerns amongst this body and others was having a deadline, right? So like a restriction on how long these suspensions could happen. And with this emergency suspension, it is still indefinite, so.
And I think it's important to note that Ryan Lombardi and Marlo Love were the two that were people that were discussing this. It was directly from them and their perspectives, as opposed to anyone else.
Thank you for that. So any questions about topics discussed there? I know that you were also there. Yeah, so Victoria was also there, so you're free to speak to anything that you found was worth noting in this body, right? I know that we have a lot of resolutions that are going to be discussed today relating to the student code of conduct, so I found that particularly relevant.
Maybe just AppSpace.
AppSpace, yeah.
Just that if anyone didn't know, the digital signage across the campus is something that everybody is really exploring right now. And depending on what part of campus you're in, specific buildings have central access and then StratComs as an overall access to be able to embed your digital ads across the university. And we talked about sharing resources through those means and making sure that everybody's on the same page on how that goes and trying to just increase access of information overall.
And that's in relation to security. And
yeah,
on campus,
security.
Yeah. So
yeah.
Security on campus.
Yeah. And if I may add, any prospective elections that may be coming up, those could be a good opportunity to advocate for those, or at least encourage participation.
All right. So just wanted to make space for that. We can go ahead and move on to item D, the resolutions for discussion. The first one we have is resolution 1 regarding proposed student code of conduct reform. And with that, Jonathan and David, I know you both have the floor, if you would like to kind of talk about what edits perhaps were made and anything else that was relevant.
You want to run it?
Yeah, so, sure. So these are the resolutions that we initially brought to the UA. They were approved from the Campus Codes Committee in December. They were brought to the UA in January, and we had a nice discussion then, and we got a lot of feedback both in that occasion and in sort of subsequent weeks after. What we're looking for today is just sort of one more round of reading these over, getting additional feedback, any last feedback. Some things have changed, right? So there was the release of the report, and so some of the wording around these resolutions has been changed to basically reflect that A preliminary report has been released. For resolution one, ideally we would be able to vote on this at the April 7th meeting for the basic reason that the comment period, the public discussion period on the report ends on April 20th, and so that would be the last meeting beforehand. The other ones, I think we could also vote then, ideally, but those are sort of less, a little less pressing and urgent, or at least there's no sort of time horizon on that necessarily, other than the end of the semester. I owe Ellen an apology. Ellen sent some very valuable edits to Jonathan, forwarded them to me, and I completely missed them. And so I did not receive those in time. So Ellen, I apologize for that. But I am now aware of them, and they will be reflected in the subsequent round.
Great.
So
thank
other
you.
Than that, we'd just love to hear any additional thoughts people have, any feedback people have on the current drafts.
All of them, or just the first
one? I mean, we could do all of them. But like, since we're on the first, if people want to go on the first, we can start that.
No, if I may clarify, for the edits that Ellen recommended, were those mostly for the first or for all?
We had various typos of different kinds, you know, open-ended quotes, and very, I think maybe some of our whereases were in the wrong place. She did a really nice job of finding a lot of those things, and so I can't confirm that the revisions we have here caught all of them, but
they did not. But
no,
but they will, because I had not had the chance to look at her edit, so I will be doing that. You'll notice, for instance, that at no point am I able to spell the acronym for Office of Student Conduct.
Yeah,
I in fact corrected it to something that was also wrong.
Fair enough. Wendy, and then
Rick. So two things. Since they're all separate resolutions, they should all be discussed separately, not all as one big lump. Here's all of our resolutions as it pertains to the campus code of conduct, whatever it might be. With regard to this first resolution, UA resolution one, there's just a couple of be it further resolved clauses that just... Again, it's just not even grammatical. It's just they should be bolded. Line 79 and line 83, the be it further resolved, those four words should be bolded just to show that it's another be it further resolved clause kind of thing in the resolution.
Wendy, I've already edited all of that. So please don't worry about it. I think there was a little bit of a slippage between, you know, edits that I sent and who got them and what has been already done. But jumped in, let me just say that once all of those edits have been incorporated, I know the drafts that we have right now have, you know, crossouts and various things going on. I am happy to do another round of editing, but I'd like to have the things that I've already done taken care of before I look at another round of revision. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification, Ellen. I wasn't aware of that. I just literally opened up the here's the agenda and here's the resolutions, and that's what popped up, and they weren't there. So I see that. So, and I also do want to give, I did look over the main four. I know there's a fifth resolution that we're talking about today. I want to give both Jonathan and David major props for listening to my issues and concerns and adjusting and amending the resolutions to reflect as such. Definitely appreciated it, you two, and thank you for listening to this 35 plus year staff members' issues and concerns.
Thank you for bearing them. They were very, very, very helpful. Really appreciate it.
Awesome. Victoria?
So my question then, just we're talking about it, we're reading and we're saying what we're doing, but we're not technically then going to vote on them since we know they're going to go back to be edited. Okay, cool. Just a question on the process. Thank you.
That being said, you know, we're happy to receive off the cuff thoughts, and then we're very happy to receive further musings in between these meetings, because our goal would be to actually present them for the next meeting, because otherwise we don't want to moot ourselves.
Yeah. Right. Ideally, this is this sort of setup where we have discussion period and then a consideration period for voting, kind of smoothens the avenue of not having a whole meeting to discuss a resolution and vote upon it that can wear people out. And so this is an opportunity for people to look through and to kind of talk, make their ideas, concerns, edit to be known. That being said, right, when it is presented again for consideration for voting, say there's a few amendments here, if they're taken lightly, we'll take them there just so we can go ahead with the voting process. But they ideally just would be minuscule, if not at all, during that period.
And the vote changes.
Yes.
So one of the questions I had is throughout the resolution, it states temporary suspensions. And as Irene mentioned, they changed in the proposed changes for the campus code of conduct from temporary to emergency. Do you intend to make that change here, or is the usage of temporary?
I don't remember if that is a proposed change or if it just gets to be implemented and it's what it is. I thought the recommendations were for these new names. So I don't know. I think we have to call them what they are. I don't know. You know better, David.
My thought sort of for the resolutions or for the whereases makes sense to call them temporary. Large because the whereases reflect sort of the evidence building that had happened through the campus codes.
From evidential.
Yeah. And so that they refer to sort of the basic problems with the code as it was. And I think in the resolutions, we are now including the restricted application of temporary suspension or emergency suspension provisions in order for temporary emergency suspensions. So in the resolutions, we try and make clear what it is we're talking about. I think it'd be weird if we said temporary solution. They're like, well, we did that by getting rid of them, but then just avoid it by another name. So in the whereas, it will keep it, I think, as temporary. But in the resolutions, the result resolutions will refer to emergency.
Great. Just to add to that point, I think that's really good that you mentioned that, Jason, just because, like you said, in the whereas, the use of temporary, but in line 53, temporary or emergency, this addresses that. We see it on 58 as well, temporary or emergency. But just in order to maintain that sentiment, we see it on 64 that it says temporary, so just perhaps adding that emergency once more. And then similarly on line 70, temporary or emergency, just so that it can be read throughout, as you were saying, to ensure that this addressed, right? Exactly. So thank you for that. Any other questions, concerns, things that would like to be mentioned about resolution one?
Yes.
Okay, seeing that there is none, we can go ahead and move on to resolution two, campus codes committee involvement in the student code of conduct review and revision process. We see the sponsor here is Paul, but I'm sure David, Jonathan, you both can speak to perhaps what edits we should be able to note were made here, and kind of, you know.
So, sorry, I had the line edits in my open line. So the major ones were to soften some of the language around the campus codes committee's mandate, as well as its authority, but also to take into account the fact that the process is basically, it's not over, it's not played out, but this resolution had been directed towards an earlier time horizon where the Student Code of Conduct Reform Committee had not yet released its initial report. And so the amendments to the resolution are intended to sort of frame it within the current situation, as well as to soften some of the language. And then that takes in some of the feedback we got in January.
Thank you.
The other is one of the parts of the resolution was initially stated that the campus coach committee shall have a formal role in appointing the chair. And I think we need to change the language of chair to the Office of Student Code of Conduct, Community Standards, whatever office succeeds it. And we wanted to make sure that that was not just the campus codes committee, but the UA.
What line is that?
So that is 69, sorry.
Thank you for that. I now open the floor to any questions, concerns, or proposals, edits upon this review.
I know that this resolution is particularly specific in its finally resolved clauses, as you stated in 69 there, with appointing the chair or whatever the revision will be. Is there interest in adding, instead of that, along with other assemblies contributing membership to the committee? Because I know it's the UA, we represent all the assemblies, and that may or may not be worthwhile adding here. I don't know.
So for that would be for the resolution, the final resolve.
Yeah, either add it in that one or a separate, be it therefore resolved.
Therefore resolved that the UA. So if it were in this, it'd be the UA, the Campus Codes Committee, as well as the other assemblies have a role in this process.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I don't have any objection to that if people will be interested.
Is that Jason? Wendy, your acknowledge?
As EA chair, because this, excuse me, sorry, I'm dealing with sinus stuff. As EA chair, with this saying that be it further finally resolved that the UA and the Campus Codes Committee shall have a formal role in appointing the chair of the Office of Student Code of Conduct and Community Standards, I am comfortable with that coming from the UA because we're the umbrella assembly for all of the other constituent assemblies. So I don't think we need to have any of the other assemblies be involved in it, because I think we can find someone within the UA or, you know, Campus Codes Committee to be a part of that search committee.
Yeah. And if I may, to clarify, my request was to add other assemblies for members of that committee rather than explicitly having a position, like a stake in finding the chair, which is why I mulled the idea of adding another be it further resolved clause, if there was interest in having that sentiment expressed. It doesn't have to be. I'm just.
Well, if you like, maybe write up
write up
what you're thinking, yeah. Send it to me, and we can include it as something to
consider.
Consider.
That's fine.
Okay. Thank you.
And I will do that.
Yes, Wendy, a follow up?
Just for clarification, I'm not sure if Jason is maybe jumping ahead, but the UA Resolution 4, which is committee appointment resolution, wouldn't that be where we put this information of, because this is just it's another committee or whatever it might be.
That's
where I was trying to come from with it, is that you don't want to have language in two different resolutions that pretty much say the same thing.
Right.
That's why I was leaning towards resolution 2. The finally resolved is someone from, let me open that one back up, that the UA and the Campus Codes Committee shall have a formal role in appointing the chair of the office, the OSCCCS. And then as far as the other ones, the, you know, campus-wide initiatives and task forces and all of those sort of things, that's something different. I apologize if I'm misunderstanding what you're trying to communicate, Jason, but that's where I was coming from with it.
Thank you for that, Wendy. I think Jason will probably write it down, and David will have the ability to cooperate with the committee and see. But I think you're right to say that we should maybe avoid redundancies. But Andrew, you're about to say something, and then I'll go ahead and head it over to you.
But again, there's times that there may just be redundancies in a resolution, and again, from resolution to resolution. No. I think that that's atypical.
Thank you for that. And then Jonathan?
Yeah, I was just going to respond that the tenor of the two is, this one is asking for a seat, and the other one, resolution 4, is saying, if you are asking, meaning Central is asking for membership seats, they have to ask the University Assembly for participants in those places where they are coming from, the University Assembly. Meaning, you know, if you want to have 2 students and a faculty and a staff, ask the UA for that. So that's a different direction. We're saying we need to be on that committee that they said, you know, composed it, and we're not there. So that was the idea.
Any other questions, concerns, proposed edits regarding resolution 2?
right. Seeing that there is none, we can go ahead and move on to resolution 3, institution of core values as a positive governance document. I see the sponsor here, Jonathan, if you'd like to just kind of reintroduce us and perhaps talk about what edits were made.
Yeah, I don't remember like substantive edits. There were some like typos, but basically the idea here remains that all of our codes and conduct and everything are all negative. And I think we don't actually articulate the positive element that we're all trying to actually achieve. And so this resolution is to try to institutionalize some sort of a positive document so that people know what the goal is in terms of our values, and then enshrine that the institution should actually inform people before they join this institution what these values are, so they can at least acknowledge that was the goal.
Thank you for that. Yes, David.
Yeah, the only real substantive changes were made largely in response to Wendy's intervention in the January meeting. So one is we have a new whereas is, I think Wendy was entirely right that while it's not listed as one of the core values, shared governance has been a central feature of Cornell's governance from the beginning, and it's reflected in the spirit of those core values. And so I think both substantively she was entirely right, but also strategically it makes sense to sort of put that in the whereas so as to not kind of suggest it's not one of the core values. So I think both substantively it was right, and strategically it makes sense. And then we also made sure that there was inclusion of staff was recognized more fully.
Thank you for that. And then Wendy, your comment?
Yes, so this is where I definitely acknowledge and appreciate both David and Jonathan for listening to me and my intervention and my little bit of an outburst during the January meeting. So I do appreciate that. I do have a question though. Line 39, the be it further resolved that formal acknowledgement of the core value statement be required for all prospective students as condition for enrollment at the university. Have we given any thought as to how that's going to happen and who's going to enforce that and who's going to be collecting all of those acknowledgements? Is that, who's taking that on?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jonathan.
There are umpteen zillion surveys and acknowledgement training things that I have to do via all of this CITI things, and the students have those as well. So this would be just a Qualtrics deal that nobody has to actually collect. I mean, it go to one person, but like this is a click box of, you know, whatever the series of like, because they have to attest to like all of the, you know, our harassment policies and all those other things anyway. So this would be one of those that hopefully looks like some